It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power.
And now, here's Al Gore's Midnight Massage Man, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar. Today we're going to try to answer some important questions. Is the USA becoming the old USSR? What's going to happen to America's trade unions once they have served the purpose of America's socialist elite? We're going to answer these questions and more as we talk with Oleg Atbashian, the author of Shakedown Socialism. Oleg, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Hi, everybody.
Am I getting your name right?
Yeah, Oleg Atbashian. Well, originally it's pronounced Atbashian, but nobody can say the right way, so I'm used to saying it as Oleg
Atbashian.
Atbashian?
Atbashian?
Okay, like Oleg Atbashian.
Atbashian. All right, I'll just call you Oleg. I'll just call you Oleg for the show.
Right, okay.
We'll do it that way. Okay, you've got this book out, Shakedown Socialism, and this is essentially a friendly warning from somebody who has seen all of this before. Now, you were originally born in the Soviet Union, correct?
Right, in 1960, in the times of Khrushchev, when the liberalization was sort of happening. And, of course, to Americans, it was still a pretty dark and oppressive place. But for the Soviets, it was a time of change when Stalin's terror regime was no more, and people were at least able to live more or less freely. But, of course, that freedom was nothing compared to the freedom that people have in the West, but still it was something. But then, of course, Khrushchev was dismissed, and the coup happened, and Brezhnev took the power, and it became just not as oppressive as under Stalin, but still the stagnation of the country was imminent, and it continued all the way until after Brezhnev's death and resulted in the collapse of the entire Soviet economy and the country itself.
What was your original opinion of America based on what you had heard through the official party media, and at what point did your opinion of America begin to change to the point of you thinking that you might like to immigrate to America?
At first, as I mentioned in the foreword, the preface to my book, I grew up believing all the fairy tales I was told by my teachers and what appeared in the media, in the movies, that we lived in the best country in the world, the most advanced progressive society, and the rest of the world lived under dark oppression of capitalist fat cats. And America was the worst country of all, of course, where imperialist policymakers were oppressing not only the rest of the world, but also their own people, who were poor, wearing shabby clothes, had no rights, were afraid to go outside in the street because of terrible crime, and not trusting anyone. And, of course, there were no other sources of information available, and the party took care of that. There was a complete information blockade. And that's why, of course, people believed the information they had. And so it was natural for us kids to wish that the rest of the world would soon become just like our country, and everybody would be living happily ever after. But with years, of course, already when I was a teenager, I was beginning to see the inner contradictions and inconsistencies in our system, even before I began to see that the rest of the world lived much better, freer, and more prosperous life than we did. Even without knowing how the rest of the world lived, I could see that what was happening inside was wrong. There was corruption and hypocrisy, and complete idiocy and contradictions on every step of the way, wherever you would go. And one of the biggest sources, we didn't have critical articles published in the media, of course. That would be, just a funny thing even to imagine that somebody would criticize the system in the media. But the place of critical media was taken by jokes. They were like this folklore that people repeated to each other at parties. When friends would meet, they would first thing exchange new jokes they heard. And political jokes were something that really was probably the best product of that came out of the Soviet economy.
would this be one of them, like we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us, or?
Exactly. That was one of the best. But, of course, there were others, like, for instance, there is no unemployment, but nobody's working. Nobody's working, but all the quotas are fulfilled. All the quotas are fulfilled, but there is nothing in the stores. The shelves are empty. The shelves are empty, but people have all the stuff at home. People have all the stuff at home, and yet everybody is unhappy. Everybody is unhappy, and yet everybody is voting to continue the system. And those were the six contradictions of socialism. And when I came here, I began to see contradictions of, not of capitalism, I began to see contradictions of socialism in America. That was the most surprising thing. So I decided to kind of compile a similar list of American contradictions of socialism. That, like, America is described as a dark and oppressive capitalist society, and yet half of the country is subsidized. Half of the country is subsidized, but they're being described as victims. They're being described as victims, but representatives run the country. Their representatives run the country, and yet poor are getting poorer. The poor are getting poorer, and yet the poor in this country have all the stuff that people in other countries can only dream about. And then the last one is that the people here, the poor have things that people in other countries can only dream about, and yet the left wants to make this country more like those other countries.
Very good. Now, you must have felt a little bit like Pilgrim, you know, or someone who left England looking for religious freedom would have felt if when they got to America, they had seen America going down the same path of religious intolerance. I mean, do you feel like you're watching a movie that you've seen before?
Actually, that's a very good comparison. No, I'm not watching a movie I've seen before. It's at first I didn't realize what was happening. And even the way the country was when I came here in 94 was so much better than what I had seen that the minor differences didn't matter. It was later that I began to see troubling signs. But at first, when I came here, I felt as if I took a time machine from the past into the future and saw this beautiful, futuristic world with all the things that nobody could even imagine existed.
Well, talk to me about those things. What did you see? What impressed you most whenever you set foot in America? What are these things that you couldn't imagine before?
Well, how plentiful everything was. Even the smallest store, grocery in the countryside, was filled with products that only exclusive stores for the party elites would have in the USSR. The freedom to travel, you could go anywhere you wanted. Nobody would ask for your passport, your documents, your papers. You know, once you pass the customs, you can go anywhere and do anything, and you can apply for a job. You didn't need a special stamp in the passport in order to live somewhere. Like in the USSR, moving to a different city was almost an impossible thing because there was a thing called propiska, which was a stamp in the passport. You know, when the government guarantees you the right to work and the right to housing, that puts you in control of the government, because then you are obligated to work and the government begins to control the workforce. And the right to housing means that the government tells you where to live, not even to choose the neighborhood where you want to live. You would be lucky that you have a separate place of your own, because a lot of people are waiting for 20 years to get a place of their own and live with their relatives, like three generations in one small apartment. So moving, that's why the government controlled the workforce and didn't allow people to move freely from one place to another. So to move to another city, you couldn't get a job in another city unless you had a residence stamp in your passport, and you couldn't get a residence stamp unless you had a job. It was a catch-22. Here, you could come to any city and find a job, and there you go. You know, rent an apartment in any place, you know, as long as you could afford it, you could rent it. Nobody would ask. There was furniture sitting right in the street. My first rental was furnished with the stuff that I found in the streets for free. That was great. Yeah.
It's amazing. We had a sister city project that went on one time between the town that I'm living in and a town in the Soviet Union. And a lot of the professors from a nearby university wanted to make sure that they understood that America wasn't all that great. So mm-hmm. they made sure to take these people into the poorest neighborhoods we had and said, mm-hmm. you know, this is America too. You see, we have mm-hmm. poor people. And their response was, these are the poor houses?
Right.
So I understand where you're coming from. Yeah, free furniture.
And then, you know, I heard stories of immigrants first coming to an American supermarket and crying there because they couldn't believe that all this stuff was freely available without having to wait in line for hours, and you just fill your car and pay for it, and that's it. But for me, where I really cried was when, I wasn't really cried, but I did get a little teary. In the arts store, where, you see, I tried to be an artist in the USSR, but I wasn't a union member, a member of the artists' union. And so I didn't have access to paints, brushes, primers, canvases, pastels, whatever art supplies an artist needs. And so when I first came to an American art supply store and I saw all those shelves packed with stuff that I, some of that I knew what it was. Other things I had even no idea what that was. That's when I almost cried. You know, how I solved the art supplies problem was that a lot of artist unions members were alcoholics. You know, naturally. And a friend of mine, an artist, just used to give me some of his own leftovers, but he told me that if I would take vodka to those artist studios and trade it for art supplies, I would be filled. I would get my quota. My needs would be met. Let's put it this way. So, you know how I heard here some leftists told me, oh, how great it was that there was an artist union or the writers union of the USSR, and so all those people were provided for and they didn't need to worry about selling their stuff to private buyers. They just created, and that's it. But there was a lot of buts there when you do it for the government. You depend on the government. The government did provide art studios and residences to members of the artist union, for instance. But the limits of artistic freedom were so strict that, like I said, a lot of those artists just were drinking themselves to death. So I would come to one of those government-issued art studio, bring vodka, which was always a hard currency, and I would get all the supplies I needed. That was how I did it there. And so, anyway, that's why I said that when I came to this country, I felt as if I came on a time machine from the past into the future. But the more the socialism takes hold of this country, I'm beginning to feel as if the other way around, I took a time machine from the future into the past. I've already seen all the stuff that is developing here, and I know where it's heading. I recognize the trait, so I feel the obligation to warn my American comrades about what's in store for them, and that's why I'm writing.
You mentioned the artist unions, and you spend a great deal of time, space in your book discussing the unions. What role do you see the unions as playing as far as helping socialists come to power, and what do you see as the ultimate downfall of unions? Are they digging their own graves and just not knowing it?
Yes, they are. And the unions helped communists to come to power in the USSR back in when it was still the Russian Empire, and they suffered for it. At first, the government adopted a labor code that was comparable to the labor code of most other Western countries, which means the workers had a lot of rights. But under socialism, they didn't have a lot of incentives. And so they just stopped working. And so the government didn't have any other solution as to get those rights back away from the workers. They take the rights away from the workers, and eventually they pretended as if the labor code never existed. It wasn't even published anymore. The workers were like serfs that were attached to a certain factory, and they couldn't even leave. That was in the 30s. And the unions themselves became just voiceless puppets of the regime. They couldn't act on their own. There were no independent unions left. They were all under control, and eventually they were absorbed by the government and became part of the labor ministry. Not only that, when the government takes the functions that the unions previously had, that's when the unions get into competition with the government. And, of course, if you're in a competition with the government, guess who will lose? So the unions lost, and the government took over. Now, look at what's going on in the United States when the unions are using their money in order to elect politicians who would adopt laws that would give them a lot of power and benefits and money. But the more they do that, the more the government is taking the functions of the unions. Look at all the legislations that has been taken. Not even on the state level, but on the federal level. There is OSHA. There are lots of regulations about the work safety, lots of regulations about compensation, about employment, discrimination at the workplace. But on the federal level, there is the Fair Labor Standards Act, not only setting a minimum wage, but also regulating pay for overtime and restricting which employees can be paid at a set salary for all work in any work week. Although the federal law does not require specific break periods, many state laws do. The National Labor Relations Act, another federal law, protects workers' right to engage in concerted activity for mutual aid and protection, even when the employees do not belong to a union. Occupational Safety and Health Administration, a federal agency, regulates safety and working conditions. Then you have the myriad of discrimination and benefit laws. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act protects employees from discrimination based on race, color, creed, religion, sex, and national origin. The Pregnancy Discrimination Act and the Equal Pay Act. Then there is the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, the Family and Medical Leave Act, and a lot of abbreviations like COBRA and others, which I don't even know how to decipher. The Fair Credit Reporting Act contains guidelines that employers must follow in doing background checks, and so on and so forth. So the government is taking the functions of the unions, the traditional functions of the unions. Basically, I'm not, as I'm saying in the book, I'm not against the unions per se, and my argument is not anti-union, because to say so would mean that the main goal of the unions is to siphon the nation's wealth into their members' pockets. No. If you view the unions as force that would help workers in collective bargaining and protect their safe working conditions and solve any disputes with the management, then yes, the unions are a necessary organization. But when the unions take uncharacteristic functions and start acting as a political force that is changing the political course of the country. That's when they become dangerous and they're digging their own grave, because when they, the result of their efforts, a large, powerful government will emerge that would have the power that the unions are striving for, then the unions will become in competition, will be in competition with that force, and they will be subdued. And once again, once more and more industries are nationalized, the relationship between the government and the workers will also change, because the workers will no longer be reporting to private companies, they will be reporting to the government. And when the subsequent economic hardships will ensue, which is inevitable with the government managing the economy, that's when the government will try to do everything to prevent that from happening. And the best way to prevent, the only way to prevent it from happening would be to crack down on the unions and prevent them from protecting the workers from abuse.
And also to make them more productive?
And to make them more productive, because again, once incentives are no longer in play, then there have to be some other ways to do it, like disciplinary actions, because that's what happened in the Soviet Union. They replaced the material incentives. Remember this great hero of the left, Ernesto Che Guevara? He was appointed the Minister of Industries in Cuba. And in a very short time, he destroyed the entire Cuban economy and financial system. Cuba used to be the richest country in all of Latin America, and now it's the poorest. Now, Che Guevara didn't believe in material incentives. He thought that even small compensation for the workers was not good, that the workers were supposed to work out of altruistic desire to improve the country's economy, you know, just for the common good, so that if all workers work conscientiously and do their fair share, then everybody would have everything. But things just don't work this way, and this genius of the left didn't realize it, so he destroyed the economy, and there's no wonder Fidel Castro sent him away to Bolivia to his death.
Well, from an economic standpoint, he has helped to sell a lot of T-shirts in the United States.
Right, he's the greatest T-shirt salesman the world has ever known.
Most of the kids wearing the shirts have no idea what they're representing, but that's true of a lot of the young liberals in America. Now, you touched on something, you brought up Cuba, and one of the things I've noticed is that virtually every Cuban I meet that has migrated to the United States is politically very conservative.
Yes.
And I'm wondering now, you are in the Bronx area of New York?
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, okay. I know that much of New York is settled by Russian immigrants. What is their typical political leaning, having seen socialism gone bad? Are they very conservative, or are they joining the left and putting out their hands and trying to see how much they can get?
There are different people there, and you cannot paint everybody with a broad brush. There are some who understand what's really going on and are very conservative. If not even conservative, they just are opposed to socialism. And that kind of puts them in the conservative camp. But there are others who are not. For some reason, they continue to believe that socialism may still exist with a human face, that everything was done wrong in the Soviet Union, but it can be always done better in some other place. And it was the belief that has kept the communist idea going for a century or so. And they think that America is such a rich country that here socialism might just work. Then there are others who had learned to milk the system back in the old country and were doing it all their lives. And now they came here. When that system was destroyed, they came here, and they know how to milk the system, and they keep doing it here. So they're not interested in capitalism. I mean, they are kind of more interested in this mixture that currently exists, because a complete socialism would make everybody's benefits irrelevant because everybody would become poor. But with the existence of free market, at least some wealth will continue to be created. And that way, all these little parasites would be able to live in their little niches, like smug like a bug in a rug, and getting all their benefits.
One of the things, if I could get back to unions for just a minute, one of the things you argue is when the government tries to mandate economic equality, you're always going to end up bringing everyone down to the lowest common denominator. I liked the way that was expressed in your book. You don't see any hope in a situation with socialism where the lowest common denominator might actually rise? I mean, instead of everyone ending up with the lowest common denominator, that you might actually see a standard of living that is slightly above what it had been before?
Not really, and that is because socialism conserves the productive forces and does not advance them. That is why the left has this dream of turning America, this wealthy country, into a socialist country, because it would last for their lifetime, you know, living off all that existing wealth. But no new wealth is going to be created. And even in the socialist countries of the Soviet bloc, the economies were able to exist because of the existence of the free market economies in the West with whom they traded. Without the free markets, they wouldn't even know the right price for the things that didn't exist when they took power, because new things are getting created, and how do they know how much those things cost? The cost creation is non-existent in a planned economy. So that is an important thing. New technologies were being bought from the West. The Soviet Union was full of talented, educated people, inventors, who couldn't bring their ideas to fruition because in that system, nothing worked. I mean, they could. It was next to impossible to implement some new technology, to get a patent and do some invention. I mean, introduce a new product, a new production line, and oftentimes those inventions were seeping to the West, and new technologies were created with them, and then those technologies were purchased wholesale by the Soviet government and introduced in the Soviet Union. That's how it worked. Without the outside source of innovation and price creation, the socialist economies of the Eastern Bloc would have collapsed much earlier. That is just one thing. You know, all the solutions that the left proposes always presuppose the existence of some outside source. None of those solutions come from the inside of the left, whether it's a socialist economy or, like, for instance, here in the United States, where we have a mixed economy. All their solutions are at the expense of taking something away from the private sector, because the government sector that they're trying to expand cannot create any of those solutions and cannot create wealth that they need. So it's all basically looting, taking away from others. And they don't understand it. That, like, I like Margaret Thatcher's phrase that the problem with socialism is that eventually it runs out of other people's money.
Correct.
and they just do not understand that. They like to talk about sustainability, the sustainable world, but it's the most absurd thing of all, because socialism is the most unsustainable society that ever existed.
To talk about sustainability when it comes to the environment. When it comes to taxing and socialism and government set-asides, sustainability doesn't interest them.
Yeah, but they are Putting it all together, like in global terms, the environment and the economy work together hand in hand because, you know, they need to save the environment by destroying the economy, the Western economies. But look at what was happening in the Soviet Union, where the environment was very badly polluted, and the industries were, let's put it this way. When I came to this country, I was surprised how clean everything was, how clean the production was. The countryside was clean, not polluted. There was so much wildlife. I had never seen that much in the Soviet Union. Nothing more bigger than a squirrel. Here, you see deer or elks, right, roaming the roads in somewhere upstate New York. You know, I was in Colorado visiting friends, and suddenly a herd of elks, big as elephants, entered their backyard. I thought I was dreaming. I couldn't believe, and they didn't belong to anybody. They just were wild elks that came from the forest. That did not exist in the USSR. The environment was polluted. There was not a place where you could go, except maybe for Siberia, where you wouldn't see some anthropogenic activity. I was a member of an environmental group in my town in Ukraine, and our main enemy was the government, because the government-run chemical plants did not clean their waste, and they were saving money at the expense of our health. And so all the bad gases were going right into the atmosphere, and all the poorly cleaned chemical waste was being dumped into the river. And that was the water we were drinking. So that was our concern. Now here, the environment is much cleaner. You can easily sue the private companies for pollution, but you cannot sue the government that creates the regulations. The government will eventually, you know, when push comes to shove, will create a regulation that would make it impossible to sue the government. And that is why, and if the economy is in a bad shape, as it was in the USSR because of the socialist system, then they were trying to save money on everything, and the first thing they saved money was people's health and the environment. They didn't care about it much at all. So these people here, the environmentalists. Oh, another thing that surprised me was that all the environmental groups were hijacked by the left. That their main agenda was the advancement of socialism, and and the government control. And they just—it's absurd. The more the government control there is, the worse it is eventually, ultimately, for the environment, because the government, when it takes over everything, it will start having economic problems, and the first thing that will be sacrificed will be the environment. That is that will be inevitable.
When our ecological movement became the environmental movement, we had a lot of former Vietnam protesters and anti-war activists looking for something to do that moved into our environmental movement. And
I think there's more to that. I think that the left figured out that environmental movement is a very convenient way to gain the moral high ground.
Yes.
To say that, you know, there is not a single rational person would object to clean environment, to having clean water, clean air, and healthy wildlife and forests. So that is morally a good goal, but the way they're approaching it is all wrong-headed, which is, of course, never mentioned in any of their brochures. that.
Well, when you talk about the moral high ground, though, you can go to third world countries where they're burning dung to stay warm and burning dung to cook their food. And one could easily argue that environmentalists blocking the building of power plants in those areas are responsible for this. And when you say, you know, as if burning dung is great for the environment.
Yeah,
and,
for these, yeah, they are holding people back, because for these guys, for the leftist environmentalists, people are the least of their concern. The earth takes the precedence. The wildlife takes the precedence.
As far as the environmental movement goes, let me just ask you this very quickly. What is the take on global warming in the former Soviet Union?
Not many people believe in global warming in the former Soviet Union, and in Ukraine, I don't even hear people talking about it. In Russia, most people make fun of it, and not in the least due to the official government policy. The Russian government is not at all interested in global warming, because that would mean that their chances to get their industry back on track would be reduced. And besides, Russia is one of the biggest producers of oil and oil products. And so the clamping down on that would be very detrimental to the Russian economy. So, of course, they would want to do that. And the fact that ClimateGate files were stolen and transferred to a Russian server and then broadcast to the rest of the world from there also makes me a little bit suspicious if the Russian government and the security force, the former KGB, might not be part of that operation, because it was in the interest of the Russian government to undermine the whole idea of global warming, so everybody would lay off their backs. And this is one of the cases when sometimes even if their motives are wrong, the result may be good.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know, you know.
We spend a lot of time talking about global warming on this program. We've had Lord Monckton and someone who, like you, mm-hmm. writes for Pajamas Media, Chris Horner, on mm-hmm. a few times. It's one of these things that's not going away, because we've pretty much taken away any opportunity for cap and trade to pass through the normal legislative channels. So now the EPA is like, well, then we'll just do what we want anyway. So this battle, as you know, is about to heat up again. And I'm wondering if you find it amusing, as I do, that every time we get together, whether it's Copenhagen or Mexico, there's talk of the industrialized world, you know, paying reparations to countries that we've damaged through global warming, and setting up a $100 billion fund to benefit countries like China so that they can retrofit their factories in such ways as to produce less CO2. China pretty much is the bank issuing America's overdrawn past due credit card. And now we're going to give them more money that we'll probably have to borrow from them, so
right.
that they can so that they can retrofit their factories and make them more environmentally friendly.
Yeah, like I have a cartoon on the cube, and it was made into a poster. Cap and trade today, cap in hand tomorrow.
I like that. That's,
but
that's
you know, this whole thing falls neatly into the global redistribution of wealth category, because this is what it is.
I believe former French President Chirac referred to the Kyoto Agreement as being the first step toward true global governance.
Right, which is a very dangerous thing and need to be avoided at all costs, because it's just like all things related to socialism are against the human nature. They do not work together with what we are as humans, as individuals, and as nations, as societies. The world never worked that way, and it never will. The socialists believe that human nature can change, that it's nothing more than a social construct, and so through proper education they can change the man to think differently and act differently and have different values, and that's why they've been doing it to our education system, and that is why it is currently in such a bad shape. But The thing is that human nature cannot be changed, and the 70 years of the Soviet experiment proved that. They've been trying to create the so-called new man for 70 years, and it didn't happen. And it will never happen because it is impossible.
Well, from
now,
a common sense standpoint, it makes sense that when you let people keep more of what they earn, they're going to be more productive. And you know what we're hearing from the left in our country now is that they want to tax us to death, including a death tax, where people with over a $1 million estate would have to give half of it to the U.S. government upon their demise.
Right, but who needs common sense when you have such a brilliant theory developed by Karl Marx and others? Now, going back to environmentalism, if they were smart enough, they would realize that capitalism is their best last chance. That if you look at the cleanest countries are the Western countries in the world, and the least polluted ones. And that is why, of course, yes, they went through a period of industrialization where the environment was polluted, and America also had its share of dirty rivers and polluted air, but it's over now, and the more there is innovation, the more clean technologies appear, the better it is for the environment, the more productivity of labor relieves people of hard manual work, the more there is opportunity for them to have to enter the service non-productive sphere, or arts, education, or intellectual work, the less there is stress on the environment. And if you stop that, if you stop capitalism right now in its tracks and conserve the productive forces at the current level, then new technologies that may actually solve all the problems with the energy may never develop. Because, like I said, the planned government system is not a way to create new technologies. Nothing new can develop there, unless, of course, you know, like the Soviet Union created a whole special town for the scientists who were working on the space project. And it would give them all they needed, and they were not part of the planned system. They were given all the resources that they requested, and they didn't have to wait as all the people in the regular industries did for spare parts or for special things to be shipped to them or to be included in the next 5-year plan. So that is the only way how things can advance, how technologies can advance under socialism. But in a normal way, where innovation takes place daily in the free market system, those innovations that would actually eliminate the need to burn gasoline, for instance, in the cars, eventually I believe that technology will be created. But it needs time, and these guys are just taking us off the highway on the nearest exit. And, you know, they're like impatient children. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Wait a little and you'll be there. It's a long process. There is history, the 1,000-year-old history that's going on, and they just don't see things in its historical context. Now, here is an interesting story I read in a paper in the 80s, that there was a group of environmentalists from Western Europe who went to area in the Sahara Desert, or in that area, on the edges of the Sahara Desert, and they brought a lot of small trees with them, and they planted a large garden there, and they did something to the soil, they cultivated the land so that they would stop the advancement of the desert and would show an example how the desert can be turned back and how humans can actually take back the land and save the environment from becoming the desert. And that was a very good thing. They collected contributions from a lot of do-gooders in Europe and maybe America too. And then, a few years later, what happened? That entire garden that they planted was gone, because the locals would come there and steal that wood and cut the trees down for firewood, because they needed to build fires to cook their food. ones. They were not technically advanced. They didn't have any other sources. They didn't have gas stoves. They were using wood, and where would they use wood if, why would they, go and train themselves to find wood elsewhere if right next to them there is this whole new forest or a garden? So they went there and they cut it down. And that they did it because they were at lower stage of development, a third world country. I don't remember which country that was, somewhere in North Africa. And that gave me an idea that perhaps you cannot save those civilizations unless they themselves become industrialized and start taking care of themselves. It's this idea of the left, of the Western leftists, that they can be guardians of the entire earth and they can conserve the productive forces and stop the third world from development and keep them living this kind of poor and oppressed lives that they had lived for thousands of years prior to that, that would be a good thing. But that's a utopia, and that's not a good thing, not for the people whom they claim to protect or speak for, not for the environment, because the environment is destroyed to a much greater extent in countries that do not have the non-industrialized countries for a lot of reasons. And one of the reasons is that, first of all, it's just the mere need for people to get their basic supplies of food and energy. And also, in industrialized countries, there is certain organization of society that doesn't exist in the third world, and a certain mentality and responsibility and understanding that doesn't exist in those societies. So all these Western ideas about keeping this little pet zoo, turning this third world into their own pet zoo where they can send donations and aid taken out from our pockets. And then once in a while, once a year, they would come to those countries and look at how those people live and how their aid is being distributed and think how great they are and how morally superior they are to everybody, because they're such great people, they're helping the world.
Ann McElhaney and Phelan McAleer, you've probably bumped into them at some tea parties as well, did two great movies. One was called Mind Your Own Business, and it was about a Russian, I want to say it was a gold mine. Well, actually, I should say Soviet, but not specifically in Russia. And it polluted the environment, and it eventually shut down. And so a private company wanted to come back in, clean up the river, clean up the environment, put a modern mining facility in that would employ all the people of this town who were unemployed. But environmentalists from around the world continue to block it to this day, and pretty much everyone in that former mining town remains unemployed and remains living in poverty. And it's a great film, and they make some of the same points in it that you just made. And one of the things that was impressed upon my brain when I was watching this movie was listening to the environmentalists talk about people around the world who were in undeveloped areas and saying, well, yes, they don't have any material things, but if you could just count their smiles. And there is this leftist mentality that there are people around the world living in poverty, but they are much, much happier than U.S. citizens.
Oh,
because of the stress that we bring on ourselves, the chaos from day to day, the demands of our work mentality.
Right, and that is the mentality of the snobbish elitist aristocrats that I think was the seed from which this whole socialist idea grew. That idea is very strong among the left, that those people are dying young because of they're inflicted by very curable diseases, that their diets are not proper. And look at the contradiction of the idea you just described and their own policies in their own countries. They're saying that people let those people be poor because they're happy, and the material wealth doesn't matter as long as people are happy. Now, look at what they're doing here. They are not saying that material wealth doesn't matter. The material wealth of the American poor, I mean, the living standard of the American poor is higher than those in the third world, even the middle class of the third world. And yet, the left claims that this is unfair and the poor need to be given more for nothing. I'm not saying that the poor should be kept poor, but I believe that the poor should be given the opportunity to earn more income if they want to have more money. And then that opportunity to earn that additional income can only come from the free market society when the opportunities are for everybody. With socialism, opportunities will be mostly eliminated, and those who can't find work would have to subsist on welfare. Well, in a complete socialist economy like in the Soviet Union, for instance, there was no welfare because nobody was allowed to be a parasite. You know, I'm using this quote-unquote because that was the official term that the Soviets used for such people who didn't work. That's a different topic. Going back to this idea of what wealth is, they are treating wealth not as the absolute value, but as a relative. They think that you are poor as long as your neighbor has more money than you have. That's covetousness. That's jealousy. That's something that one of the Ten Commandments told us, warned us about. You can't covet your neighbor's property. You can, if you want the things that your neighbor has, work for it. You can't just take it away from him and make you equal. So that's what the left is doing here, but when it comes to the third world countries, they're poor, and that's great. Let's keep it this way.
So class envy is fine in the United States, but not in third world countries.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. I mean, class envy in third world countries also is at work because they're saying that they're putting guilt on the Western producers because they have so much while the people of the third world have so little, so they have to share. And, of course, that kind of sharing can only be done with some sort of an organization, some sort of global governing force, and they imagine that they would be the ones in charge. They would be in charge of this redistribution of wealth. And that's a pretty lucrative position that gives a lot of power.
You stated on page 56 of your book, and I'm just going to read this and then get your comment on it, in the absence of articulate opposition, free enterprise will lose its former attractiveness and Americans will elect a socialist government that will nationalize key industries and begin openly to dismantle the framework of capitalism. When you talk about the absence of articulate opposition, do you feel that in the creation of the Tea Party and in the wake of the 2010 midterm elections that articulate opposition is starting to form and may be effective?
Yes, thank God for the Tea Party. Because previously, even with the Republican leadership, I didn't see any articulate opposition in defense of capitalism and free economy. If you look at the last presidential elections, McCain did such a poor job defending that. He sort of mentioned free markets, that they're good, but he eventually was being Obama light.
Yeah.
He figured out that if people like Obama, then he must be saying something right, so he should follow. But, of course, he was like smaller, softer Obama, and he couldn't compete with the original. So that's why he lost. I think what is happening is that the conservative movement in America was heading in the wrong direction in that regard. They sort of conceded this moral high ground to the left. Okay, these people, the socialists, have some good ideas. They want to work for the common good, and this is also what we have. We want all people to have all the good stuff, and we all need to share. Just that the left is going too fast. They're being too radical about it. We just need to take smaller steps, and we'll eventually get there. So their idea was not very different from the left, it's just they were not as radical about it. While The point is that the leftist idea is the most abominable and immoral philosophical construct that ever existed, you know, next to cannibalism. Because in a way it is, metaphorically speaking, a cannibalistic philosophy. And the evil of that philosophy needs to be exposed and showed, and the morality of capitalist society, free markets, needs to be promoted and spoken, shouted from every rooftop. And that was not happening until the Tea Parties came around.
Now, you've actually spoken at a number of Tea Parties, have you not?
No, I've attended them, but I haven't spoken at them, no. I was invited by some Tea Parties to give speeches to their gatherings,
okay,
to a group in a room, but not at the actual street events. Maybe eventually. I wouldn't mind if somebody invites me.
Well, for those of you listening out there, we do have a lot of Tea Partiers listening. You are available, and we're gonna make sure they know how to contact you for a number of reasons. First of all, the book is Shakedown Socialism. And if you'd like to order a copy for yourself, you need do nothing more than scroll down to the bottom of the Blog Talk page that you're on right now, and you will see a copy of the book. You simply click on that, and it will take you directly to Amazon.com, where you can order your own copy of that. Now, you also have a website that Rush Limbaugh has referred to as a Leninist version of The Onion, and that is thepeoplescube.com. Tell the listeners a little bit about what they might expect if they visit this site.
It's a political parody, satire. We are pretending that we are this sort of Stalinist Politburo discussing current events from that point of view. And so you will see pictures of Lenin, Che Guevara on that site, and we all pretend to be comrades. We call each other comrades and discuss the problems of the world revolution and using Marxist phraseology, and discuss what's going on right now and what Obama is doing and what's going on in the world. Some people find it hilarious. Other people find it, so it's kind of controversial. But I'm getting more and more fans every day, so I'm doing something right.
People who find it controversial, do they not get the joke? I mean, in America, the way that we insult each other's websites on the left and the right is we make references to Poe's Law. You find the left throwing that accusation at the right a little bit more, in that they can't tell whether our conservative websites are actually conservative websites or parodies of conservative websites. Because they claim it's hard to tell the difference. And I'm wondering if some of the people who opposed your site or not liked your site maybe don't get the joke.
Well, I did receive some emails saying that, what are you doing? Your communist ideas are wrong. They will never work. So I have to tell them right back to them and say, hey, well, this is a parody. We're actually on your side. But, you know, some people just don't have enough sense of humor. Some people are just browsing quickly and don't stay too very long to understand what's really going on. They're just used to getting their information in the first 3 seconds of looking at the page. And this is something that needs a little more time to understand. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who get it right away, and they send me emails saying, hey, this is the greatest website. How come I never heard about it before? Others are sending me emails saying that, thank you for saving me from drinking, from alcoholism, because in this depressing world, this is the only thing that lifts my spirit. Some people go there every morning with a cup of coffee to get new laughs and get some charge for the day. And, you know, I understand why they're saying it, because I started as the main writer on this website, but then I get joined by a lot of great people who are contributing, and from all over America, from Texas, from Pennsylvania, California, Washington State, Wyoming, Idaho. There is, some are students, some are college professors, some are writers, professional writers, some are construction workers. We even have one pig farmer from Minnesota.
Oh.
And who is doing great Photoshop. So, you know, you would be surprised how talented these people, all of them are Americans. Most of them have lived their, you know, have several generations of roots here. Others are immigrants like me. And we're all friends. We all find common language there, making fun of socialist ideology and the left and the Democrat Party and all these leftists and rhinos. And it's the most witty, the wittiest, the funniest, the most informed bunch of people you will ever find on the Internet. That I can promise you.
Well, I look forward to visiting the site myself, and I hope all our listeners will take a look at it as well. Now, also, you mentioned that you'd like to speak to Tea Party groups or at actual Tea Parties. Can the listeners contact you at redsquare@thepeoplescube.com, or is there another
Yes,
email?
That is my contact email. I have a few email accounts, but that's the easiest. If they go to thepeoplescube.com and click on contact in the menu, they will see my face wearing black mustache and a red army hat with a red star, and because I'm posing there as Comrade Red Square. And they will see Comrade Red Square's email, redsquare@thepeoplescube.com. They can just click there and send me a note. It's as easy as that. Or, alternatively, if they have already seen the website Shakedown Socialism, they can click on contact there and reach me through that email as well.
And are you actually selling those People's Cubes? I saw a video clip of you holding the People's Cube that essentially has, what, red squares all the way around? It's a Rubik's Cube with only red squares?
Right. It is a politically correct Rubik's Cube where all sides are equal.
I've been trying to solve it. I seem to always end up where I started. I don't know.
Right. It guarantees equality of results.
It certainly
As opposed to equality of opportunities. We have equality of outcomes. It's also colorblind friendly, and it teaches a lot about diversity and a lot of other progressive ideas. So that is that was the joke behind the whole website, thepeoplescube.com, is that red cube, the Rubik's Cube with all sides equal, is called the People's Cube.
Well, I'm sorry that I had you on after Christmas. We could have encouraged the listeners to give one to a progressive on their Christmas shopping list. But there's always next year, and of course they probably make very good birthday presents for progressives as well.
Thank you. Maybe next Christmas they're always available.
Oleg, I've enjoyed having you on the show today. Thank you so much for spending an hour of your time with us. Once again, the book is Shakedown Socialism. The sites are shakedownsocialism.com, thepeoplescube.com, and if you'd like to invite Oleg to speak at one of your Tea Party events or one of your Tea Party meetings, you can reach him at redsquare@thepeoplescube.com. Oleg, once again, thank you for being here today. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Have a great day.
Been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Galar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.